Case of the Frozen Pussy, Slip or Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will find on the Miami Memoirs podcast. Strange Cases and Wild Tales presents real case histories and true stories related to the law practice and experiences of a creative Florida attorney reaching out over 60 years. There's more than meets the eye. In these sparkling memoirs, Florida attorney Louis Ress uncorks a caseload of true, weird, wonderful, and wild stories from an always eventful 6 decades of life in the law. Before we begin, I would like to tell you about a new book from Louis. Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring, Round 2 from the Amazing Life and Times of Legendary South Florida Attorney Louis Ress, takes readers from Brooklyn in the 1940s, via a spell in a top-secret Army department, and a transatlantic solo flight in a replica Spirit of St. Louis, to adventures in and out of the courtroom in a sometimes rougher-than-ready 50s and 60s Miami. The book is available on Amazon, just search Louis Ress. And now let's begin.
Hi everyone, welcome to Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Ress. Today we're on episode 35, Larry the Third. Louis, why is this next chapter titled Larry the Third? I remember we did Larry the First, right?
Right. Sometimes it's not so good to do everything in order.
Ah.
And you have to have a little guts and creativity and take things out of order, twist them around,
yeah,
make them interesting. Actually, it's supposed to come after Larry 1 and 2, but I've taken it out of order. I'm having some fun.
Yeah, of course.
It's really, I don't know if you've ever been to the Bahamas in Nassau.
Mm-hmm, I have, actually.
Oh, well, yeah. This is about that, and it's about contracts and contract law, and the crazy story about all these elegant British and Canadian barristers and solicitors, and how they're just as devious and nasty as anybody else. They're not such elegant people.
Huh.
So Larry turns out to be more elegant than they.
All right, let's hear all about it.
The cruise ships used to tie up, and the passengers would toss coins into the water in the harbor in Nassau. But Nassau has changed, and the harbor water isn't crystal clear anymore. It became big cruise.
Yeah.
And I hate to see the cruise lines come in and ruin
all that pollution.
Yeah, and they bring all these junky businesses with them. They sell watches, and they sell china and glassware and jewelry and things. And it's really not the country anymore. It's just another shopping center that they developed to cater to the ships.
Yeah.
And then they develop these rides and the resorts, a whole bunch of activities. Go to the Pottery Barn, and we'll take it to the carpet factory.
And it has nothing really to do with the country at all.
It's money.
Of it. Yeah.
They create these things to make money.
Mm-hmm.
The kids no longer were able to dive for coins that were being tossed from the ships because the water wasn't clear.
Oh, it's disgusting. Yeah.
The straw market became touristy. It used to be all handicrafts and stuff,
mm-hmm,
and it became T-shirts. It was a hodgepodge of T-shirts and jewelry stores, and Hog Island, which is the old Hog Island, was now known as Paradise Island.
Mm-hmm.
And Huntington Hartford used to own Hog Island. And now it was connected to the mainland by a toll bridge, and now there's two toll bridges. There used to be water taxis would take you back and forth, little boats, small wooden boats, and they're mostly out of business. I want to know about that first bridge because I drew all the documents for that bridge, which went into effect at midnight, and only a few people knew who actually owned the bridge.
Oh, wow.
It was owned by somebody's father.
Huh.
One of the companies, they slipped it out of the company. There had been a small casino at the Britannia Beach Hotel where Howard Hughes had hidden out on the top floor. Now there's a second bridge, and there's a gaudy new casino, and there's a huge hotel with enormous fish tanks through which you can walk in underwater tunnels, and you can plunge down high water chutes, and you can tan yourself on private beaches and get massaged at the spa at this big hotel. and dine in glamorous restaurants. And it's now known as Atlantis, and everyone's heard of Atlantis.
Yes, yes.
Well, it was never there. And when they put it in, Nassau will never be the same. Mm-hmm. It made it into a real touristy place.
Yeah. So what about Larry?
Well, I get another telephone call from Larry. He said, I just need you to get over to Nassau for a few hours. Get over to the offices of this Bay Street attorney and straighten out a few clauses in the contract that I'm going to sign. And Larry was selling a large oceanfront parcel of property on Paradise Island. He had gotten in over his head. Mm-hmm. So he said, I'll have you back home before 10 o'clock tonight, Luis. Luis, he loved to call me Luis.
Yes.
He said, I'll have you picked up by the Cessna, you'll get back. So I was picked up by the twin Cessna at 4 in the afternoon in Fort Lauderdale Airport, and I was in the attorney's office in Nassau by 6.
Hmm.
It was very fast.
Yeah.
And the attorney's office was on Bay Street, and it was upstairs through a poorly lit narrow hallway over some tourist shops. The walls of these attorneys' hallways were covered with plaques describing multiple corporations with supposed offices in that building, including banks, insurance companies, oil and gas groups, and many other international corporations. So when they say they have an office in Nassau, mm-hmm. actually they have a plaque on the wall, and they were just mailing addresses or what we call drop boxes.
Right.
There were no such corporations there. So that's the first tip-off about
yes.
the ethics and the concern that they have for integrity.
Yeah.
It's a phony baloney stuff.
And so what was the meeting like with Larry?
Well, the buyers were, the attorneys were grouped around an old wooden table, a long table with gold trim, high back chairs, very formal. And there was a smaller chair at the end of the table that was reserved for me. They were expecting me. They were representing the buyers. I noticed that I was sitting substantially lower than they were, even though I'm short. They literally had me looking up to them, so it was rigged.
Yeah.
I do that sometimes in a mediation, so I can't complain.
Yeah, it's a strategy.
I noticed they were working me over.
Mm-hmm.
They handed me a contract of about 50 pages, and they expected me to call up Larry and have him sign it, and then I leave back to go to Fort Lauderdale. I looked around the table and I introduced myself to the buyer's attorneys. There was Sir Lloyd Graves, the host, and they hear again titles. The English love that,
uh-huh.
Sir this and Lady that. And, he was Sir Lloyd Graves. And to his right, there was the Canadian counsel, and they called him Mr. Herbert Myers of Toronto. They were pleasant, but They weren't smiling. Mm. They planned on building a high-rise hotel for a consortium of investors, and the purchase price for the property was going to be $8 million U.S. dollars for a lot, a vacant lot.
Yeah, wow.
Well,
that's a lot.
For that kind of stuff, it's what you pay for an oceanfront property to build a hotel.
Yeah, wow. And who had been representing Larry up until now?
Well, Larry was trying to cut corners, and he had a lot of self-confidence. He was a real character, and he wanted to save a large attorney's fee, so he was representing himself. After all, it was a relatively simple deal, his vacant lot for $8 million. You know, as is, where is, take it or leave mm-hmm. it, that's it. He suddenly realized that he was over his head, and he knew that I represented the developer of Freeport, and I also represented the owners of Paradise Island, where the Atlantis was.
Mm-hmm.
So I was familiar with Bahamian real estate. And once more into the lion's den, he goes, Luis, I need you. Well, one.
And so what was the proposed agreement like?
Well, one glance at the first page, it said representations and warranties. And it became clear that Larry was being hustled.
Mm.
They were making him the guarantee of their success. Of the guarantor of their profits. They had rezoning and construction plan approval clauses that had no place in what Larry was describing to me as a sale of vacant land. They had him, Larry, guaranteeing the rezoning, to build a high rise, and they had Larry guaranteeing the construction plan approval.
Oh, no.
Right. And the more I read it, the more onerous the contract became.
Yeah.
Larry was responsible for obtaining the building permits. He was responsible for access to the property for the construction vehicles and the cranes.
Wow.
I spoke to Sir Lloyd Graves, and I said, "Gentlemen, I would like a little more time to review your comprehensive contract. Can we adjourn for the evening?"
Mm-hmm.
So we agreed to meet at 10 in the morning. And where was Larry? Certainly he was not at the airport to greet me. And the pilot, Jeff, was waiting for me in the reception room. And I said, "Where's Larry?" And he said, "Larry asked me to have you room with me overnight. He's tied up right now and he'll get back to you." Tied up? Not for me. I'm knocking myself out, jumping over to look after him, and he's tied up. Nope. I found Larry at the roulette wheel in the Britannia Hotel with the sexiest woman I had seen in a long time.
Wow, Larry.
She was blonde with green eyes, wearing a white low-cut sequins gown with stiletto heels and a diamond necklace with a large matching emerald as a centerpiece in this diamond necklace. It matched her eyes. I won't bother to describe her figure. You've already imagined it. She was a knockout.
Yeah, she sounds very beautiful and glamorous. For
she,
sure. Yes.
She was no extraordinary lady. She was articulate and intelligent. As I explained the proposed contract to Larry over a drink, she paid attention and she gently told Larry to listen to me. She was a Columbia University graduate with an MBA from the Wharton School. You know the Wharton School? Mm-hmm. That's the University of Pennsylvania. That's it. You know, that's the best place.
Yeah.
And a very, very successful stockbroker. And she had offices on Wall Street, and she owned an apartment overlooking the East River on Sutton Place. Do you know where Sutton Place is in New York?
No.
Well, it beats Park Avenue, and it beats Fifth Avenue. I think it's the number one spot, Sutton Place.
Oh, wow.
It's over the, it faces the East River, near the Williamsburg Bridge, I think.
Oh, okay.
Well, Larry was smitten with her, and they were all over one another, touching and stroking and smiling and flirting, and I had to get out of there. I couldn't take it. So my final words to Larry was, "Larry, I need you tomorrow. I can't negotiate for you." And he says, "Louise, can't you see I'm busy? You take care of it."
And so what did you do, Louis?
Well, I went back to the cheap room that he got for me, the room with the pilot, Jeff. And I spent 3 hours going over one of the most one-sided contracts I had ever seen. Jeff, the pilot, had brought me a toothbrush.
That's nice.
The next morning, I knew enough to buy some necessities, including a couple of shirts, socks, and underclothes for 2 more days. I knew where we were heading.
Yeah. And so what happened at the next meeting?
Well, the three gentlemen facing me were brittle and formal. We went over each of their clauses, and they had the advantage because we were working from their contract and not mine.
Yeah.
At noon, when we had time for lunch, they would have the agreement redrafted, reprepared, and I had a chance to meet with Larry, and we were working the clauses out. And Larry was in a lovely suite facing the ocean. He was in the hotel, and his lady friend was wearing a silk robe, and she was sitting up in the big bed.
Oh, well, what a meeting, huh?
Yeah. I said, "Larry, it's been a battle, and they're being unreasonable. I don't like dealing with them. They are not trying to make a fair deal. They're trying to hustle you. Luis, I know what you're saying, but I would very much like to make this deal happen. You compromise, and you try to get it done."
And so what was next?
Well, back to the conference room on Bay Street with these lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
The amended contract, which is now 52 pages long, was distributed.
Wow.
It was distributed. Wait a minute. The changes were not as we agreed. There were 3 new paragraphs committing Larry to additional conditions.
Oh, gosh.
The compromises we had agreed upon were rephrased and actually made to be unenforceable and meaningless.
Oh, no.
I was fit to be tied. I said, "Gentlemen, it is apparent that your clients do not really wish to purchase this property because you have made this transaction impossible and unacceptable."
And so for how long did this go on where they just did not write up a good contract?
Well, it was 8 o'clock at night, and we were ending the second day of fruitless negotiations. I said, I am tired, and I'm going to excuse myself. We arranged to meet at 10 the next morning, and they would speak to their clients and get back to me. It was the same routine. I reported back to Larry, who was totally absorbed in wining, dining, and gambling with his new girlfriend. He kept giving me words of encouragement. He said, Luis, you're getting closer. You're getting closer.
This guy. Oh, man.
So the next day, back to the conference room. It was Friday. I had gone over there on Wednesday. It was that Friday. And evidently, the terrible three, these three connivers, lawyers, had gotten instructions from their client not to lose the deal. So they were a bit easier because they knew I was ready to walk.
Yeah.
However, each time we agreed to compromise, the document came back with words that were with different meaning.
How frustrating.
By Friday night, I was ready to head home, and Larry kept telling me that he wanted to sell the property and he liked the price. And the buying team, the buyer's team, who was supposed to be elegant gentlemen, kept playing these unethical games. It's not the first time that's happened to me, by the way. That's happened to me with a top-notch firm out of Chicago, the same thing. So slippery would be a kind word for their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing I went through with a corporate merger, the same way, slippery. The document came back different from what we agreed.
Oh, no.
I finally suggested that we dictate the changes out loud to Sir Lloyd's secretary together.
Mm-hmm.
By 11 p.m., we had a contract, which had Larry not pressed me, I would have never accepted. But he was making the ultimate decisions.
And where did you find Larry?
Ah, this time I found Larry at midnight. It was Friday night. He was in the casino gambling.
Of course, of course.
But he took time off to sit down with me.
Oh, good.
I said, Larry, we've got a final draft, and it's what you told me you could live with. I have to tell you something and get your instruction. These gentlemen haven't discussed a subsoil condition clause. They've covered riparian rights, which is the ownership of the land on the water to the mean high tide level on the beach. Mm-hmm. So they have to figure out where the tidal goes to in relation to the flow, the tides and everything.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And they know about beach access to Bahamian waters, which is... everyone has access to the beach. So if you have a piece of property, you've got to give an easement to let people go to and from the beach.
Mm.
They know about that. But they didn't ask for a subsoil condition clause. That means what's underneath the surface
right.
of the soil.
This has been a problem before.
Right. There could be minerals down there. There could be mineral rights. Somebody else might have oil rights to dig there. They haven't talked about that. I normally would suggest to them that they receive this protection so that they'll be able to build on it.
Yeah.
You know, that there's no, the foundations will be good. But they have been nasty and slippery and less than honorable. And it's not your obligation to look after them. They have three lawyers to do that. The contract, at their insistence, says that it is fully inclusive and that there are no warranties or guarantees, oral or in any other writings, except as expressly set forth in the contract. Do you know of any subsoil problems? No? Good. I certainly don't. But in any event, I see no reason to look after them when they've been so nasty to us.
Yeah, it's true.
Right. So the contract was signed on Saturday morning, and I got Larry out there, and he signed it, and I returned home later that day.
You must have been just so relieved already to get home.
Well, my three-hour trip on Wednesday turned into an ordeal lasting 3 days.
And so was that the end of it, or was there more to come?
Oh, no. That was not the end of it.
I figured.
About a month later, a month goes by, and Larry calls. He says, Luis, they started construction. They drove pilings. The pilings disappeared. They drove more pilings. Those pilings also disappeared. They tried spread footings, and the concrete disappeared. You know, where they have spread out the concrete into a big pad.
Uh-huh.
That disappeared. Quicksand. What do we do? They're claiming that the property can't be used for the purpose they purchased it, and they want to overturn the contract and get damages.
Hmm.
I said, Larry, they put in the clause about no outside guarantees. They have no subsoil clause. They should lose in court, in the Bahamian court.
And did you wind up in court?
Oh, you bet. If you haven't been in a Bahamian courtroom, you should try it on your next trip to Nassau. It's a sight worth seeing. the judges dress in full long wigs with a red robe, and the judge sits on an elevated bench. The attorneys, counselors, wear full black robes with white collars and curly white wigs, which they bring to court in big round hat boxes. It's really like a show. And I wasn't used to seeing Bahamians in that setting, and it was as though we were in a British high court. And our counselor was the prime minister's law partner.
Oh.
It was pretty good.
Yeah.
And the judge asked a few pointed questions, including who put in the limitation of guarantee and warranty clause into the contract, the one that states that the only warranties and guarantees are the ones included in the written contract. And our lawyer said, they did. Then it was all over. Larry kept the $8 million. I think the property is still vacant. He stopped dating the blonde. And I wonder what happened to her.
Lewis, that's quite a story. There's quite a lot going on. What's the moral here?
Well, there's a lot of morals. First of all, you understand how the judge ruled. He said, if it's not in the contract, you don't get anything. You put the clause in that everything you get is included in this contract and nothing outside the contract is admissible.
Yes.
And you didn't put in the clause about subsoil, so you're not protected with subsoil, so you took it as it was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it cost them $8 million. To my knowledge, to this day, that lot has never been developed.
Wow.
It sits empty.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure those lawyers learned their lesson, hopefully.
Well, there's a golden rule. The golden rule is do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Yeah.
And the converse is don't expect people to reward kindness because they're unfair, selfish, and mean and cruel, and they're nasty, and they're driven by crime, cheating, and bribing.
And, you can't expect anything from
if
that.
If you look at what these guys did, they were connivers.
Yep.
And so I didn't have any obligation. Normally, I would have told my client, we ought to tell them to put a clause in to protect themselves because we don't want to defraud them or have them lose money because of it's our problem. We're supposed to sell it and guarantee the condition that they can build on it. But I wasn't going to do that when they and reach out to give them something that they hadn't asked for when they were trying to hustle us.
Yeah,
and they were
being sneaky,
honest.
Very
so
sneaky.
So it's the converse. If you're unfair and decent and selfish, don't expect other people to bend over and be kind to you and turn the other cheek. That's very, very nice, but it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
It may be good for religion, but it doesn't happen. So the golden rule, do unto others, doesn't always apply. You know, the history of the golden rule.
No.
Does
it come from sort of Confucius kind of Chinese culture, or did I get that wrong?
Yeah, well, the golden rule comes from, in fact, it's universal.
Yeah, from every culture.
It comes from the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from the Old Testament and the New Testament. But if you look, there's Confucian, Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, Judaism, Taoism, Zoroastrianism, Stoicism, all of them have the golden rule in there. I looked. I was interested, and I looked it up. Ancient Egypt, 500 B.C., they had the golden rule. India in Sanskrit, 400 B.C. Tamil, the Book of Virtue, they have the golden rule. The Greek philosophers, 600 B.C., expounded the golden rule. Persia, in the Pahlavi texts, going all the way back, that's even before they express it. So it's nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the human rights, the rights of man, Rousseau, Jefferson, the Declaration of Independence, all relate to it. They all relate to it. So people should reach out and try to understand other people. And in so doing, they would be better at what they do. For example, I think every judge should spend a night in prison, one night, before they start sentencing people to 20 years in prison, which they did to a friend of mine for no real justification to do that. He hadn't harmed a soul. A judge should spend one night to see what they're doing when they beat you up and rape you and you're scared out of your wits that you're going to be abused. Doctors should spend a day in a wheelchair. Or maybe even better still, lying on their back and putting their legs up in stirrups and see what it feels like, what women go through. Lawyers should spend a day in court as a client and see what it's like to listen to the lawyers yell and shout and scream. So these are the ethics of reciprocity. And these are it's a global ethic, and I'm a great believer in it. And talk about contracts. Now, what happened here in this contract? The courts, in my opinion, have, and I understand it, they take a very property-oriented, business-oriented
approach
to contracts. They say once people contract to do something, agree to do something, and express it in writing, or express it in an enforceable way where you partially perform an oral agreement, then you enforce the terms of the contract that they've agreed to. And you cannot legislate or interpret or stretch or insert your beliefs as to what's fair, right, or appropriate or good business into their contract. It's their contract that they agree to, and that's for stability in business. I think that's a load of nonsense, and I would say crap if I was, and as an attorney, I don't mean to be disrespectful of the law, but there's a saying, and it's in the Cornell Law School moot courtroom, the law must be stable, and yet it cannot stand still. And I looked at that when I was in law school. I said, what the hell does that mean?
Makes so much sense.
And then I started to think about it in my law practice. And then I started to listen to the politicians tell the lawyers, I'm appointing you to the bench because you're going to enforce the law. You're not going to make law from the bench. They hate that, make law from the bench. We'll make the law, and we'll control the legislature, and we'll take the bribes, and we'll look after the special interests, and you have to enforce the law that we put in there. Don't interpret it. Don't change it. Don't legislate from the bench. And that's the present state in Florida. The governor feels very strongly that way, and that's the state with the president of the United States, the former president. They don't want people to change the law. Well, Roscoe Pound was the one who came up with that saying, the law must be stable, and yet it cannot stand still. And what it really means is that the law has to be amenable to society's needs. And has to flex. And so you can't say, well, unlike the Federalists, the Constitution is interpreted as of the date it was written, 1779, and that's how we look at the as the law. Well, you can't do that because, I mean, horses were creating manure in the streets. They didn't have cars. There was no electricity. They didn't have interstate commerce. There was no such real thing. They didn't have trains. They didn't have planes. They didn't have telegraph. It was a different world. And as society changes, the law has to change. And the legislature sometimes doesn't keep up. So the courts flex the law to try to service society. So what happens? Well, in society, you know, and this is a really a law, this is a lecture on contracts for law students, because that's what it comes to. Where do you draw the line? And this we're talking about ethics in, in law, in contracts. Suppose you put in the contracts clauses that are onerous. That well, they say that's the agreement of the parties. For example, you get on the on your computer, and you want to buy something or do something, renew something, your license to use the computer, and there's a 30-page single-spaced contract that comes up on your computer that before you can, or even to run the half marathon, it's 30 pages there of a release. And you can't read it and understand it, and you're not an attorney. And even if you were, you don't. So you say, well, I need the internet. I've got to use it. Okay, I click here.
Boom. I agree.
Click here, you agree. Well, that's terrible. That should be illegal. It's unethical. You're not represented by anybody. It's taking unfair advantage. And it's a service that you should be entitled to have. This is not something like buying a yacht where you can say, well, I'm not going to buy your yacht if I don't like the terms of the agreement.
Some of these are necessary
right.
You got to purchase it.
Then sometimes people in an industry get together and they form a uniform contract. So all the dealers of cars, let's say, have the same contract to buy the car. Mm-hmm. You find that they lobby and they meet and they have conventions. What do you think they do at these conventions every year? The Automobile Association, manufacturers, whatever. They work on, the lawyers are getting together to work on these contracts that they all adapt. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example, a terrible, terrible example. Stock brokerage companies. When you sign a brokerage agreement with a stock brokerage company, every single stock brokerage company in the country has the same clause, the same form. And it says that if you have a dispute with them, you will resolve it by arbitration with an arbitration association that they have created for themselves.
How is that?
Under the rules that they have created for themselves. You can't go to court
legal?
And sue them. It's not. It is legal because the courts say you agreed to it. Mm. And this is what they say. Well, you agreed to it. You signed it. Therefore, you're bound by it. But it's so unethical, in my opinion. It's so wrong.
It is, yeah.
So now you have a dispute. What happens? You tell the broker to sell out. You want to sell with a stop-loss clause. Mm-hmm. If my stock goes down more than 10% or 20%, sell. And you put it in writing to him. And the broker's busy having martinis or something. And the stock market goes down. And they don't sell you out. And you get wiped out. You're on margin. You get wiped out. Okay? Now, you file a claim. And you sue them in court, and they say move to dismiss the case because you have this brokerage agreement, and it says arbitration. Well, where do you file the arbitration? In the Stockbrokers Arbitration Association.
Yeah. That's...
So now, if you have one stockbroker there, let's say Smith Barney, for example, with the Lehman Brothers. Mm-hmm. So you have a claim against Lehman Brothers. Well, Smith Barney sits in as the arbitrators in that case on that panel, and then when you have a claim against Smith Barney, Lehman Brothers sits it on their back. Mm. So they look after one another.
Yeah, it's all a club.
And it's a very unfair, crazy. And, by the way, there's no rules of evidence. There's no depositions. There's no appeal. There's no appeal.
Wow.
They can do anything. Unless it's fraud, they can do anything.
That's crazy. So, it's like the Wild West.
Right. So that's an example of what goes on. Well, the courts enforce that. Well, maybe it's time for the courts to say that's against public policy. Oh, you're legislating from the bench. You're telling us what's ethical and what's not ethical. Well, you got to do it.
Yeah.
That's just a good example of it. But then they have clauses, waiver of jury trial. it's right in there. You know, when you sign something, let's say you're buying a product of some kind, a vacuum cleaner, and they say sign, and it's a sales contract, and it says you agree to only sue them in South Carolina, in some Calhoun County,
right?
And you agree to put up a deposit of $500 before you sue them, and you agree to waive jury trial, and if you don't file a claim within 6 months of the time you get the vacuum, you can't. It's the time expires, and you have to give them written notice.
Wow.
In the city of New York, there's a thing: if you were damaged by a pothole, you know, you have to give them written notice within so many days to the certain clerk or something, or you can't sue the city.
Wow.
It's a short
statute
of limitation.
I'm sure the process takes forever. So who knows if you're going to make it on time?
Right. Right. Does that give you an idea?
Oh, yeah.
Of some of the things that concern me? Oh, you get a ticket. Let's say you're parking. You give the car to a parking valet.
Valet,
and they give you a little receipt. Read the receipt. It says, we're not responsible for anything. If the car has an accident or we have an accident with the car, you got to read some of those things.
Mm-hmm.
We're not responsible for the theft of any of the items inside your car. So they open the trunk, take your spare tire, you get it back. There's no spare tire. They said, we're sorry. There's no evidence of damage to the car, and we didn't take the spare tire. And what are you going to do?
Wow.
So those are some of the things. They should have international contract rules for everybody, applying all over the world. Okay, that...
That's quite a bit.
So
quite a lot.
I think I've given you enough to tell you that the courts have to have the right to enforce the ethics of society and not allow contracts to be one-sided where people don't have a bargaining power and they're not at arm's length and they're not fair.
Mm-hmm.
And we are heading in that direction, hopefully.
Hopefully,
Maybe we'll get there. Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for that hopeful ending and for all the knowledge that you gave us today, Lewis. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Don't forget to like our Facebook page, Miami Memoirs, and be sure to pick up a copy of Lewis Rest's new book on Amazon.